Hello, this is MR Radio, I'm GW, and I've got a pretty easy ride this evening because I'm not actually conducting this interview. Kimiko is going to handle it by herself, and it's an interview which flows from, I think it's fair to say, quite an insistent invitation that she issued to Matt Parrott of Trad Youth. We're hoping for, if not fireworks, on the subject at hand, which is Christianity, the utility thereof, and traditionalism. Certainly an informative and lively one. And with that, I'm going to get out of the way. And Kimiko, take it away.
Yeah, it's great to be here. So, Matt Parrott, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well this evening. How are you doing, Kimiko? I'm pronouncing that properly.
Yep, you're pronouncing that right. Yeah, I'm doing fine as well. Well, I suppose I might as well just get straight into it. The first question I'd ask you really is how do you see traditionalism? What exactly is it?
That's a very big question. I am a radical traditionalist Orthodox Christian, so I see radical traditionalism as sort of the metapolitical instrument with which I sort of analyze the world and politics, and also it was important in arriving at my Orthodox Christian religious convictions, from which my metaphysics and my belief stream. That's distinct from how many understand radical traditionalism as another word for perennialism, where one might be an Orthodox Christian or Sufi Muslim or really almost anything, and see that as sort of an avatar, an extension of the perennial singular religion, and seeing most religious traditions as being valid to one extent or another. As far as what radical traditionalism means to me, it would be an orientation towards honor, fidelity, transcending the self, identity, tribalism, strongly rooted in naturalism, as well as in the sacred texts. And I absolutely refuse to believe that there's any real separation between truth and tradition, as far as how many contemporary Christians, they go for the young earth creationism and stuff like that. I just don't see that. I see geological work as its own theology, as you get to learn directly about how God created the earth over millions of years and such. So I hope that at least partially answered your question.
So I do have a follow-up question to that now as well.
Okay.
When you have this thing which you described as all religions having some amount of validity, you're not able to hold that position if you're a monotheist, though, are you?
Well, I'm not a perennialist, so that's...
Exactly,
that's...
you're saying it's distinct from perennialism, so you'd have to actually invalidate those religions which do not...
Yes,
specifications of Orthodoxy, of course.
Yes, I believe that Orthodox Christianity is the one true religion, and that the other religions are to varying degrees wrong, though to the extent that they very frequently manifest abstract radical traditionalist principles. I believe there's a lot of wisdom, and in a lot of their esoteric traditions, I believe in their own way, they would bring a person closer to God and to saintliness.
Okay. You probably get this question quite often, but what makes you so certain that the religion that you've chosen is the correct one?
That's a very important question, and you know, ultimately it comes down to faith, and I would argue that anybody's ultimate metaphysical convictions also come down to faith. I think that the smug humanist internet atheist is standing on an even higher pile of presumptions and unfalsifiable axioms than I am. But why I would sit on my particular pile of axioms is I believe if you look at the Orthodox Christian faith from a historical perspective, from a logistical perspective, from an ecclesiastical perspective, it most closely approximates these abstract principles of radical traditionalism, which, as I said first, were sort of my lodestar from which I eventually, that was my true north to find the true faith. And Orthodoxy, in my opinion, more than any other Christian denomination or any other faith tradition, is closest in terms of fidelity to its original doctrine. It's structured to preserve that doctrine. It's managed to stand firm against the Mongol hordes, against the Islamic invaders, and against Marxists. And now I think it's holding the line against modernity. So it's sort of, I took that plunge to where I truly believe it, nothing comes before it, including my radical traditionalist principles. But my radical traditionalist principles were very much what brought me there.
Okay. Well, speaking of ecclesiastical principles and so on, I see you have an article up recently, which was Kyrill. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yes.
Yes, I see that Kyrill has an article up in which he's talking about forced demographic replacement of Eastern Europe and Orthodox ethnotheology. And he talks about what appears to be 1872 Council of Constantinople when they're talking about philetism. What they seem to be doing here is they're trying to escape from the charge of philetism because Orthodoxy is against the conflation of race and faith for some reason. So how exactly do you guys reconcile this when they have so much stuff written about how you're not supposed to have racialized churches, if I can put it that way?
Okay, well, the first thing one must recognize is that the Council and Canon Against Philetism was a rather recent one in the late 19th century, which the Bulgarians still haven't even agreed to. So one can be in communion with Orthodoxy without ever buying into that ethnophiletism is a heresy. That being said, ethnophiletism is actually, when it was designed for a specific problem of people being denied communion in mixed ethnicity areas. Of saying, like, this is just a Romanian Orthodox church, and we deny communion to anyone who is Bulgarian or what have you. And all it amounts to is saying that you can't deny communion or deny someone the mysteries on account of their ethnicity. Within the past 20 years, this has sort of been exploited as a wormhole and then expanded to come to the farcical conclusion, which is only really accepted or acknowledged in the West in the past decade or so, implying the farcical conclusion that white identity and only white identity is a bona fide canonical heresy. The hypocrisy and transparency of it is evident to global Orthodoxy, though the relatively small community of Eastern Orthodox in America are struggling with this. I don't dispute that it's certainly been a problem for us.
Okay. Would you not say that they have a point on some level because of the stances that were taken by Jesus of Nazareth himself, though? That their expansion, their recent expansion into this area may have something to do with their actual reading of what Jesus said. Because Jesus himself also doesn't strike me as much of a racialist.
The first thing is, if you're looking at this from a historical life cycle perspective, if something just emerged in the Christian faith within the last few decades, it's quite plausible that that's actually a result of an infiltration into the church that the church went on for thousands of years without being anti-white, and without Christianity having whiteness as some sort of formal heresy one could get excommunicated for. That's really an insult to the tradition, to think that something so modern and tacky as contemporary Western anti-white neo-colonial faggotry would actually be like a timeless canon. It's really embarrassing that we even have to deal with this, and eventually it'll be purged out of the system. As for Christ's ministry himself, he didn't really touch on this matter, and nobody believed he did touch on this matter until very recently. Like the one we always get thrown in our face is, there is no Jew nor Greek nor man nor woman in the eyes of God. And on a certain level, yes, we are all equal and equally sinners, and equally God's children. And we don't dispute that. We've never disputed that. And yeah, there is that level of universalism in the Christian faith. Christianity is a universal religion. Christianity is not the West, and the West is not Christianity. You hear that sometimes out of some Christian traditionalists, and while I kind of respect the sentiment they're going with that, and I would like to see Christianity take the lead, Christianity is a universal faith. But what does that mean? It does not mean that the tribes and genetic diversity, the races, or the families, or the genders are to be done away with. That's part of God's creation. And, you know, that neither Jew nor Greek immediately jumps to neither man nor woman. Now, we can clearly see from the rest of church tradition, the rest of the Bible, that whether you're a man or a woman is a very consequential thing.
Yes, it does seem to be so.
Yeah, and you can expect within the next decade or so, as the homosexual and transgender thing takes off, that community will use that same line to say, here, it says in the Bible, you're neither man nor woman in the eyes of God, so you gender is an anti-Christian construct. And that's exactly the kind of fruity...
of course, the Bible has so many things in it to prevent them from being able to really arrive at that conclusion, though. However, on the issue of the race-based issue, there's not much telling them otherwise. If, for example, the early church, for instance, at Antioch, Alexandria, Ephesus, Rome, and so on, they had quite a number of, I guess you could let's say, non-Jewish people in them, because obviously, you know, there's a lot of non-Jewish locations. However, they still allowed Jews in their churches. So this forms almost a historical beginning, where you know, Jews are heavily involved in the creation and formation of these religious doctrines that would later be held by so many. But at the same time, a traditionalist youth network, you guys take a very hard line toward Jews, which, you know, taking a hard line toward them is a very good idea. It's just that I don't understand how you managed to accomplish this while you're simultaneously adhering to a religion which was shaped by them at the beginning.
Well, there are two things with the Jewish question, perhaps more. But the central thing is that regardless of Jews' theological status, they are a different racial and ethnic group from us, okay? So there's that. So allowing them to join us in worship or whatever, like Brother Nathaniel. Brother Nathaniel is a convert, and that's beautiful. We love Brother Nathaniel like you wouldn't even know their tradies, but he's still not our people. Would I join him in fellowship and communion? Absolutely. Am I allied with him in the global struggle against organized Jewry? Absolutely. But as far as that does not naturally or theologically or intuitively flow, that we should merge into one shared identity. We have separate identities, and Brother Nathaniel's Jewish identity is not mine. That being said, it's important to understand that the origin of Christianity was an anti-Semitic phenomenon. It was a breaking away from the Pharisees. People.
That's not what it looks like to me.
Well, you didn't read the Gospels then, because Jesus is persecuted. Well, you would see that Jesus was persecuted by the Pharisees. That they were the central antagonists throughout the New Testament, and that the Pharisees went on to become today's Jewish community. And the Jews who joined Christ in rebelling against the Pharisees, those are, in my opinion, not the same thing as the Pharisaic Jews that we have now.
Well, that's only an accident of history that these people are still around, because the same Jesus of Nazareth was also hanging out with different groups of Pharisees, or people who would be described as Pharisees. So I don't see how there's like a massive difference here. They had some minor differences between themselves, and then Jesus of Nazareth was sold out, essentially, to the Romans, who then got rid of him as was.
You don't see a major theological difference between Christ's ministry and the teachings of the Pharisees, which modern Jews have held to?
No, because one is a servitor of the other. Submit someone like Rabbi Emden, for example. The whole reason that they created Christianity in the first place was because of the fact that they wanted all of the Gentiles to be capable of being converted to following Noahide laws. That was the actual reason. And so, of course, they can't make you adopt Judaism wholesale, because Judaism is very much configured so that the Jews can use it, and so the Jews can be part of it, because it's very ethnically targeted toward them. But something like Christianity, which is universalist, or Islam, which is universalist, will allow you to basically come under their legal framework without having to be part of a religion, without having to be directly part of their religion.
Okay. Do you have any evidence for?
Yes,
for this?
I do. Yes, I do. Jewish Encyclopedia, unedited full text. If you look at the 1906 Jewish Encyclopedia, they have a line here that reads, and I'm just going to read, it's only two paragraphs, I'm just going to excerpt two paragraphs from it. Quote, "Inasmuch as the Jews had their own distinct jurisdiction, it would have been unwise to reveal their laws to the Gentiles, for such knowledge might have operated against the Jews in their opponents' courts. Hence, the Talmud prohibited the teaching to a Gentile of the Torah, quote, the inheritance of the congregation of Jacob, end quote. Rabbi Johanan says of one so teaching that such a person deserves death. It's like placing an obstacle before the blind," and that's Sanhedrin 59a. And then the next paragraph is Rabbi Emden, in a remarkable apology for Christianity contained in his appendix Seder Olam, gives it as his opinion that the original intention of Jesus, especially of Paul, was to convert only the Gentiles to the seven moral laws of Noah and to let Jews follow the Mosaic law, which explains the apparent contradictions in the New Testament regarding the laws of Moses and the Sabbath. With the conversion of the Gentile to Christianity or to Islam, the heathen and pagan of the civilized or semi-civilized world has become almost extinct, and the restrictions placed on the ancient Gentile are not applicable to the Gentile of the present day." So in other words, they're allowed to treat you like a Jew, come back to the quotation, "except insofar as to consider him a Noachian serving all moral laws, in contrast distinction to the Jew, who, as one of the chosen people, observes in addition the Mosaic laws." And so you kind of, so, you know, end of quote. But you, so they're basically saying you kind of become a subset of them, and they don't have to fight you so hard because you half agree with them at that point.
Okay, well,
so they're quite open about
that.
First
of all, those are encyclopedia. Charitable rabbinic interpretations offered centuries after the actual situation went down, speculative in nature. And I think looking at a life cycle approach, the historical hostility between the Jewish community and the Christian community, I think puts to rest the notion, as well as the stark, that Christianity is a revolt against the Jewish way of thinking, the Jewish way of behaving. The Jewish resentment, and that's with Nietzsche accuses the Christians, and Christ specifically, of introducing this sort of slave morality. If you look at it, Christ is providing an answer to that, whereas the Jews continue to run with that degenerate, legalistic, hateful view of the world.
Okay, so if you really believe this, the Old Testament, for example, which parts of the Old Testament do you repudiate? Or the books which they have grouped as the Old Testament, which part of that would you repudiate, given that one would imagine that Christianity is actually built atop what went before?
We have the understanding in the Orthodox tradition that the parts of the Old Testament which we have kept are the parts which are not infected with the Pharisaic virus. That being said, traditional Christianity doesn't dwell too heavily on the Old Testament, aside from just sort of laying the groundwork for Christ's arrival as the Messiah. There's certainly parts of the Pharisaic tradition which are contemporary with the later parts of the Old Testament, which indicate that there was sort of a this part is Pharisaic, and that part is aligned with the Christian tradition, and it's a complicated question.
Yeah, I can imagine it must be difficult for people to figure out what is what then if they're going on this framework. Also, what seems to be happening here is that it's almost as though you're competing against the Jews for control over who is going to be the true heir to their God. Because you do acknowledge that basically you and they are worshipping the same God, right?
Not exactly, because, I mean, in
and also the Muslims, of course.
Yes. In a flimsy historical sense, as far as the lineal descent of the people and the words, the short answer is yes. The long answer is no. When they misinterpret God as a hateful Jewish supremacist villain set out to gift the entire world to them and kill everybody else, that's not my God. My God is the Christian God, who's a loving God, and you see prefigurations of him in the Old Testament, and you certainly see him in full bloom with the coming of Christ and his ministry in the New Testament.
Okay, well,
it's the same way, like with the Islamic God, there's so much deviation with the Quran and everything.
Well, there are some similarities there too. For example, you've heard the quotation about how God claims to be a jealous God. That God claims to be a jealous God, and then in the Hadiths, you have instances where Muhammad asserts that, you know, Allah is a jealous God and no one guards his jealousy more than Allah, and so on. You can actually do a side-by-side comparison and find that in many instances, the things which Muhammad is saying about this God Allah is essentially just him copying stuff that he's that he appears to have read from the Torah. That's what it looks like as well.
And that's a problem we have with trying to interpret and understand a lot of these sacred ancient texts within our kind of modern understanding of like publishing and proprietorship and ownership of text. Like, who really transcribed the Old Testament? With the flood, you have the Epic of Gilgamesh, you have all these tribal stories that are commensurate with the Noahide flood, and to attempt to perform an exegesis where you just arrive at this very linear, direct, literalistic understanding is to me a Pharisaical way of looking at the Bible. The Old Testament is a complex historical record with genealogy, with really kind of tangential to the modern Christian stories of various kings and who replaced them and the battles between different kings that you would expect in an ancient text preserved over that time.
Hmm. Okay, so I have a follow-up.
Okay, go ahead.
I have a follow-up question from previously that I ought to have asked but did not. You're making this distinction between Christians and Jews, but also if you look at John 4:22, for example, Christianity seems to support the idea that salvation is of the Jews, because Jesus of Nazareth himself comes and says, quote, "You Samaritans know very little about the one you worship, while Jews know all about him, for salvation comes through the Jews." Like, what precisely do you think he meant by that?
Okay, well, first of all, the Samaritans...
And also, why was Christianity presented to the Jews first? Surely, okay, was intending to have anti-Semitic stuff happening, why would he not have just presented it to Europeans?
Okay, well, first of all, the Samaritans, by any kind of modern standard, would themselves be considered Jewish. They were a branch of, racially...
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, so it's saying that our particular group has the true religion, and if you look at biblical tradition, both Old Testament and New Testament, a consistent theme is calling people who seem like counterintuitive to be called, taking thieves and entrusting them with a great mission, taking prostitutes and entrusting them with a noble mission, taking wretches and making them into important figures that are unlike. That's part of the Christian tradition, is that no matter who you are, it's possible through God to live a noble life and achieve a noble calling. And where I'm tying all this back with is the Jews would like to imagine that God chose them because they're supreme to deliver this message to the world. And if you look at the tradition, both Christian and pre-Christian, you would all almost come to kind of an opposite conclusion, that God chose the least worthy people to share that message. And of course, they took it in the wrong way and have come to us today as being the chosen people, which is so tremendously arrogant and contrary to how the Christian would understand God. As far as it makes sense for him to deliver the message there, because the Jews are the ones who need this message the most.
Well, so give some examples.
It actually make perfect sense to drop Christ right in the middle of the.
At that time, it appeared like they had a bunch of fundamentalist movements essentially running around. They were regarded as pretty uptight. I would think that the Jews would have been regarded as pretty uptight.
Well, not by God. He saw what they were coming, and he had the prescience to see how wicked that priesthood had become. And I think it makes a perfect sense that Christ would come among the Jews at the center of the world kick off that message.
Okay, well, explain to me this then. I said earlier that it looked like it was an in-house quarrel to me. So for example, if you put the positions taken by Jesus of Nazareth alongside those of the Hillel rabbinic school, then you discover pretty quickly, or at least I seem to see pretty quickly, that these positions are actually side by side. So it would appear to me that Jesus is actually adhering to the Hillel rabbinic school, arguing against people in the Bible who appears to be coming back at him from the Shammai rabbinic school. So many of these deep arguments that they're having, or when he's, you know, when they say, oh, he came to the Pharisees, and, you know, there are these arguments where they tried to trap him, and so on and so forth. The reason they're doing that is because it's two rabbinic schools having an argument with each other. And so in their tradition, they used to have very heated rhetoric, where, for instance, when Jesus refers to his opponents in that one passage where he says, oh, you are all a den of vipers, etc., etc., or your father is of Satan, or something like that. That's almost like he's trolling them, because that was the tradition of basically, you know, you're supposed to elevate the rhetoric to the maximum amount that you can to try to appeal to the crowd around you. And so why would people then take from that he was sincerely opposed to the Jews at this point when he was one himself? That's just how they argued, right? At least that's how Jews appear to have argued with each other. For example, Jesus of Nazareth seemed to believe that the oral laws that are being followed by the Pharisees, the Shammai rabbinic school in this particular case, were not in alignment with written law. So he was upbraiding them on this and saying that, you know, you shouldn't create oral laws that are different from the ones that are written down on the paper. So, you know, Jesus of Nazareth was very much a literalist in terms of his interpretation, I guess. But he definitely seemed to support the written law of Judaism. For example, he comes and says that he had come to fulfill the law. And that's in Matthew 5:17-18. So as to accomplish their purpose.
Okay, well, it seems like you're sort of trying to come at me from parallel, Pat, whether Christianity was created Nation of Islam, Yakub style, as a way to defeat the Goyim, or whether Christianity was just a rabbinical school of thought that spiraled out of control, a sincere rabbinical school of thought that spiraled out of control. It seems like two self-contradicting modes of attack. As far as the rabbinic school that spiraled out of control, I would just have to kind of rely on the people, the contemporary people of that age, who saw it as so much more than that, as an actual refutation of an inversion of the Pharisaic tradition that was universal, that belonged to the Gentiles. So,
well, the thing is, it says right here in the red text, though. Matthew 5:17-18, he writes, well, says, I should say, I'm reading from New Living Translation, by the way, don't misunderstand why I have come. I did not come to abolish the law of Moses or the writings of the prophets. No, I came to accomplish their purpose. I tell you the truth, until heaven and earth disappear, not even the smallest detail of God's law will disappear until its purpose is achieved. And so what is its purpose?
Well, its purpose is global Christianity, and the Old Testament speaks of the Messiah who would come and fulfill the law, and explain how that law is to be applied, and establish a church and a faith to achieve that. And that's what Christianity is. Christianity is the fulfillment of Jewish law.
Okay, Christianity is the fulfillment of Jewish law, then, you're saying. But, and you've also just mentioned global Christianity. Meaning, are you foreseeing that you should try to convert people who are non-Christian in all regions of the world to Christianity? Would that be an imperative?
Yes.
To what extent would that not just undermine everything that you're doing on the ethno-nationalist front?
Because you can be Christian while still having separate nations. I really don't understand why that's so confusing. Europe, the entire continent, including well into Africa, the idea that because an Ethiopian was Christian that he was also an Englishman was, up until just a few decades ago, considered stupid. And I still consider it stupid.
Yeah, but isn't this the logical... isn't this the logical evolution of what was going to happen? Obviously, the same thing happened within Islam as well, where at the beginning, they had no conception that the different tribes would be united together. But by the time of, around the time of Muhammad's last sermon, for example, he was already openly calling for racial mixing and basically the destruction of all ethnic groups. It's a progression. Of course, he's not going to start out and come out with it immediately. No Abrahamic religion ever comes out immediately in your face and tells you that they're about to destroy you. They always wait until much later.
Okay,
These things evolve over time. No one obeys it exactly at the beginning.
Okay, well, I'm not an Islamic scholar, but the notion that Christianity is this secretive cult that waited until at just around the time that the neo-colonialist imperative of capitalist and Jewish machination would make it convenient to do so. Suddenly, surprise, we're for destroying all the tribes.
Not surprise. They had been doing it before. For example, why did the French Empire go into Vietnam? For what purpose was that? Originally,
it was exclusively, entirely an economic decision as part of the scramble.
Why were priests involved so deeply then? And why was their excuse at the end that they were going to come in to rescue these priests, because of the fact that these Catholic priests had set up a system of converting the top layer of society and then trying to deprive the rest of society of the ability to eat food? And then when people revolted against them for this, then, oh, now they have their neo-colonialist excuse. Sorry, not neo-colonialist, colonialist excuse. These things seem to flow together. I would not say that it was entirely an economic decision. There was a faith-based element to this, where they thought that, you know, Christianity should be universal and that these people shouldn't be following Buddhism, so on and so forth.
As far as with the French Catholics in Vietnam, or the Spanish Catholics in Spain, or the Western Protestants in North America, or whatever. I think you're oversimplifying and blaming Christianity for stuff which can be more parsimoniously explained by capitalist colonial imperatives, with the church opportunistically tagging along. Without being the primary driver of those things. I don't defend everything about the colonial age. I don't defend everything that the various Christian denominations did during the colonial age. I believe there was a lot of excess and a lot of abuse in that period. But I don't think that that can be properly laid at Christianity's door.
Okay. Well, to what extent do you think a universalist way of apprehending the world leads almost inevitably to the kind of things that were experienced back then?
I don't think it does. If you look at Christianity has been confluent with nationalism for thousands of years. Judaism has been...
When you say that, it would be despite it rather than because of it.
Why would you, after the first 1,000 years of doing something, I don't think you can say that any abrupt change can be blamed necessarily on the system unless you can really
I wouldn't give it 1,000 years in the first place. Nationalism only started to come into existence around the time of the late 1700s, about 18-something, when people had a consciousness of a genetic connection to national borders which they have drawn, which were supposed to be actualized politically, as opposed to previously, where you just happened to be born within a particular district and defended it because the king was telling you that you should.
I subscribe
to the view that nationalism is quite a recent innovation, as opposed to something that had existed in Europe going back that far. Because I don't think they had such seamless borders. For instance, if you take this thing which is now known as France, the entity which is now known as France, I don't think that border was drawn there because someone decided, oh yes, let's draw this border perfectly around the quote-unquote Frankish people and so on. No, same thing with Germany, for example. Germany didn't become a country, and there wasn't a thing called Germans in the sense that we understand it now, until quite late. Same thing with the Italians, for example. Because you had unification of Italy had to occur. Why would unification of Italy have had to occur if they had nationalism before that?
Okay, well, Westphalian nationalism and Romantic nationalism are definitely modern developments. Basic human tribalism is etched into our DNA and is a part of every historical tradition, and ultimately it's... Okay, well, nationalism was simply... the reconciliation of tribalism with the colonial age and industrialization and the rapid developments that came from there. The smaller tribes, like in Germany, simply weren't geopolitically or logistically capable of surviving and subsisting as distinct communities. And you had this quasi-organic, somewhat artificial development of a German identity, which even now, like, how different is the German from the Dutch or from the Dane or from the Austrian? Is all, you know, there's definitely bad, you know, I hate this kind of stuff because that's the way anti-racists always go about it is, oh, well, you've had some confusion and complexities with history and identity, therefore it's not valid. So when I'm speaking, I'm speaking in more generically, and as I think you are too, and whether Christianity is pro-tribal or anti-tribal.
Yeah, that's precisely what's happening. I'm asking in the more generalized terms. It's just that the evidence that you're using to back it up, where you're saying that, okay, well, the last 1,000 years of tribalism proves that Christianity supports tribalism. Well, I would also go further and ask, you know, what were people doing before Christianity came along? Then, if you're going to use tribalism as the gauge instead of nationalism, then, you know, what were people doing before Christianity came? Surely they were capable of being tribalists without having to have been Christian at all. So why do it in that case?
Okay, well, I don't believe that Christianity is the only way to be tribal. Christianity is consistent with tribalism. Christianity is peaches and cream with tribalism, as you see with Orthodox nationalism, and how, like, with a Greek person in the United States, how, like, their faith and their identity are almost interchangeable. And that's the way Christianity was meant to be, and that's the way Christianity was for the vast majority of its history, really up until the last few decades for the Orthodox Church. And even then, only as a regional aberration here in the West.
Okay. I want to ask also about a theological issue. The idea that Christianity gives you the opportunity to have eternal life in paradise after death, to what extent is that harmful to the individual who's trying to fight in this life when their reward is placed outside of this life?
I mean, ultimately, if you look at, like...
Before you go, sorry about this, I should also add that not all religions place the reward after this life either, because there are plenty of religions which situate the reward inside of this life, rooted in this earth, whereas Christianity is one of its unique claims to fame, I guess you could say, is that it places the reward outside.
Okay, well, an authentically humbled Christian doesn't do what he does for the reward. He does what he does to serve God. who is awesome enough to be deserving of that. Now, there are implications of rewards, and as far as exactly how those play out, I'm just going to have to pull the mystery card and say I don't know how that all plays out in the afterlife. I just know that I have a duty to serve God and to be a humble servant of his faith and of my family and of my folk. Now, I would say, as far as how it's confluent with struggle and what that would entail politically and strategically, I would look towards Kadrianu and his life and legacy as an example of how believing in a transcendent, awesome, monotheistic God who's above and beyond this world can truly ground and root an ethno-patriot in a way that simple biological and self-serving arguments about, of course, you'd want to have a better, you'd want to have a white country because they have a higher GDP than brown countries. Whenever you tie that transcendent worldview in with the defense of your faith with your family and folk, you have the tradition of martyrs that you have in the Christian faith, where people are willing to die for their people. In the Orthodox tradition, we have what are called ethno-martyrs, it's a beautiful construct where you die for God through dying for your people. And that's, you know, that would be my...
Isn't that just incidental then? Where they're saying you didn't really die for your people, you died for that particular God through them. I mean, that's essentially what you're saying there. This then leads me to the other question. You mentioned just earlier about serving God because he is awesome. And by that God, we're talking about Jehovah in this case, because he is awesome. What precisely about him is awesome?
He created us. He is our heavenly Father. He all the blessings we know in this life are through him. How can you not see your life as a gift? Presuming that you believe in God and don't just ascribe it all to happenstance and chance. What an awesome happenstance this would be for me. To have just randomly arrived here, but I'm created with a purpose. I don't just exist to amuse myself or serve myself, but I exist with a purpose of serving as a soldier for the God who created me. That's the Christian worldview.
But couldn't human beings have created their own purpose? Why would you have to look to this God to get a purpose in the first place? Because people, many people say this, they almost sound relieved that they've been given a purpose by this, I suppose you could call it the I'm tempted to use the word dictator given the behavior we're talking about, but I'm not sure I want to use that word, but why would you take orders from this particular God? Like, what has it done to merit other than saying, you know, it may have created you, what has it done to actually command your obedience? Like, why should you respond and say, yes, I'll do exactly as you say?
Because that's my purpose. The thing is if you believe the Christian faith, the problem here is so many kind of like half believe the Christian faith. Okay, if you truly believe that God created you to serve him, then it's really just a very simple logic error when you don't serve him. Whenever you, like, I have chosen to serve God, and I'll serve him because I guess he's pretty cool. Or, you know, of all the faiths, I like Christianity the best. Then you're not really a Christian. To be a complete Christian, I think you would agree, one really has to completely hand his life and even his reason over to his creator.
Yes, I would agree that is the criteria for the real Christian. That is also a question I was going to ask you, but you answered it without me having to ask it. Okay, well, let's talk about the character of this particular God then. In the Garden of Eden, for example, why do you think it is that Jehovah told Eve not to eat the apple?
Oh, okay. Well, my first problem here is that I have a large contingent of anti-white, Antifa who follow me around and are listening to this podcast right now, trying to find some example of me being heretical, trying to lean on anything to excuse further persecution within the church. So on some of these more subtle theological arguments, I really have no choice but to say I don't know, and it's a mystery. So I guess all I would say about the tree of knowledge and Adam and Eve is I believe that there's a profound allegorical sense, and the sort of modern anti-Christian notion that's like saying choose God or choose worldly knowledge is, I think, an extremely limited interpretation of that.
Okay. My next question then is, if it is the case that Eve was being limited to not consuming the apple, to say, you know, I mean, we both agree that basically Jehovah did say don't eat it, right? We both agree that. We both agree to that.
Yes.
Right. And so what was the outcome of her eating it in your view? Because I've heard obviously many different views from people as to what the outcome actually was, some of them quite subtle. So what was the outcome in your view?
I want to answer, but I really can't. I apologize, because this is kind of like a dancing around sensitive theological issues that my enemies will use to get me. I do apologize. I want to answer. I have, even if I'm wrong, I want to have this conversation. But I unfortunately, you're just dancing a little bit too close to where my enemies are trying to get me kicked out of my church. So
okay.
I apologize to our listeners, too, and I apologize to you that I can't really go out in the weeds with you on some of this stuff.
Okay, I'll back it off slightly and make it more of a civilizational question then. Talked earlier about tradition in Western civilization. Would you say the Western civilization has more than one tradition, in the sense that there is also an underlying tradition in Western civilization which is more, let's say, Promethean in its approach to civilizational development, development of productive forces, and so on? So when Christianity claims to be the only tradition that the West has had over the last 1,000, 2,000 years, depending on how long you'd like to count, but there's also a very Promethean tradition which strives against it, which was actually running coincident within the same society.
The thing with that is that you saw, before Christianity even had anything to do with it, you saw the life cycle and death of that Promethean spirit in the late Roman Empire. I mean, if you read Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, for instance, you'll see the exhaustion, the lack of imagination, the fatalism, the nihilism which was consuming the late civilized European people. And a lot of that is really sort of the healthy primal vitality of our people before the perversions and distractions and problems that come with late civilization got in the way.
Didn't that time come back again once development of productive forces kicked off with the British Empire and, of course, obviously the Dutch who developed the first stock markets, of course, but the British Empire following swiftly afterwards, carrying out all this awesome development? I don't know if our British viewers will agree, but, you know, you could almost say that the British Empire was extremely, you know, Promethean. I mean, just everything that they did, even the flag design, which is being used in this country, in a way, if you look at it and you go behind the symbols of these that are overlaid onto this flag, you end up with what appears to be kind of like Venus over the water.
I'm not opposed to traditional European customs and festivals and vitality and spirit. Christianity doesn't replace the traditions and spirits of the people who accept Christ into their heart. God made us diverse, and He made us white people distinct from the other peoples. And you see our spirit manifest in both pre-Christian Christian and post-Christian and non-Christian mm-hmm. and every variant thereof. There's a certain nature to our people, and you know, I think.
However, tradyouth.org, however, seems to be arguing very much against that spirit quite often, because you guys have actually called this thing. Hold on, I've got it in front of me, actually. Yes, you guys have a post up here by Matthew Heinbach, which is called Weapons of the Occult War Revisited, A Christian Perspective. And in this report, you guys make it into a battle between good and evil, in which, basically, the things which I am saying are good now and the things which you also are saying are part of European people, you guys have actually placed them into a camp which you are busy attacking.
If you look at our mission statement, you'll see that we are not attacking the other traditions of the West. You'll see in Heinbach's other works, which I don't have. I'm not as well prepared for this interview as you are, obviously. You've done a fantastic job of preparing. Heinbach has our perspective on the pre-Christian traditions is we see them as having been baptized, okay, and see no contradiction between the fact that Christmas and Easter and so many other European celebrations have pre-Christian roots. I've called myself publicly numerous times a pagan Christian, in a sense, in that I think the Arthurian tradition and such are both pre-Christian and Christian, and that there's mm-hmm. prefigurations of Christianity in the Christian tradition. This sort of dichotomy between Christianity and paganism or heathenism or whatever word you want to use is sort of itself a modern neo-pagan construct that sort of props up.
Well, the question then is why is it that I don't get this impression from Heinbach, for example? In his writing, he talks frequently about how much he despises Freemasonry, for example. But you just invoke the Arthurian legends. Now, the Arthurian legends were essentially Rosicrucianism, under the mask of Christianity, right? Which led directly to what? That's one of the streams of thought that goes into Freemasonry. So how can he be arguing against this thing while simultaneously recognizing its validity?
Because he understands that your way of trying to draw these clean and simple lines. I mean, Freemasonry is such a mess of like old peasant guild legends, mm-hmm. of the Arthurian legends, of Kabbalah, Christianity,
Hermeticism,
anti-Christian, Promethean. It's an absolute hodgepodge of occult faggotry, grabbed from every possible source.
They include all of these things because obviously they believe that you should look at absolutely everything, but they do lead toward a particular conclusion. Like if you want to choose one thing out of all of those, the Promethean thing definitely seems to be the thing which they angle toward at the end of the day, which incidentally is probably why you've ended up with Queen Elizabeth II being the head of Freemasonry, for example, at least in the United Kingdom. Because what do you think of when you think of that other than Britain? It seems completely logical that they would have ended up this way. But Heinbach consistently inveighs against this.
Well,
when he's quoting Deuteronomy 18:10-11, he's written in this particular article, quote, "There shall not be found among you anyone who burns his son or his daughter as an offering, anyone who practices divination, a soothsayer or an augur, or a sorcerer or a charmer, or a medium or a wizard or a necromancer," end quote. And then he goes on for the next couple of paragraphs, essentially talking about he criticizes the New Age, he criticizes alternative spiritual but not religious philosophies, and then he talks about the desire to rebel against Christian culture, etc., etc. So it seems as though he is very antagonistic toward the alternative traditions. He even talks about, literally calls for the deaths of witches in this particular article.
Okay, well,
even though witches would have been here before Christianity arrived on the scene.
Okay, well, I prefer to baptize them over drowning them. You'll have to have Heinbach on for everything Heinbach says. We do work closely together, but we are not the exact same person. I think you're kind of cherry-picking. Heinbach is definitely more strident on these matters than I am, but I think you're cherry-picking, and that I know from experience that he works with the neo-pagans and stuff like that. Now, advocates of Freemasonry and Judaism We definitely firmly draw the line there because we do see those as anti-traditions.
Okay, why do you? This is the other question I wanted to ask. I've actually seen people hyphenating this, where I'm not sure if it is you, but I'm thinking since we're on the subject of Heimbach, it'd be interesting to talk about it anyway. I'm pretty sure it is him hyphenating Judeo, what he's calling Judeo-Masonic, where he's put a hyphen between these two things.
Yeah.
How does he accomplish this? Like, how does he actually manage to get that hyphen in there without him thinking to himself halfway through, what on earth am I writing?
Because the past 300 years has been the Masonic elites in the West have been collaborating with the Jewish elites in the West. These two separate and distinct historical forces have teamed up to destroy traditional Europe and kill off our people.
Is it not just incidental that you guys happen to be standing between these two fires, where on one hand you're criticizing Jews, and on the other hand you're also facing a Masonic challenge, and so it begins to look as though these two people are close together, even though they're actually attacking you from completely different angles, from opposite sides?
Well, that's why we don't call it Jewish or Masonic. We say it's a Judeo-Masonic twin attack. There are definitely, and that's an argument I have continuously, is people think that the peasant merchants are basically just the Jewish channel. And no, the peasant merchant force in Europe is distinct from Jewry, and we would have a lot of these problems.
No, but I'm saying that the hyphen does not denote that you see these things as completely different. Because when you put a hyphen between them, it's almost as though you're saying they're deliberately merged together.
Well, they're merged together in a common interest, but they're not the same thing. I mean, I don't know if you've got a better way for me.
I don't know how you guys arrived at the conclusion that they were merged together, even. Like, for instance, how many Jews have you seen in Freemasonry, for example? Particularly since the criteria they offer for males, at least, when they're going into that that organization, the criteria seems to exclude Jews almost implicitly, although they don't write it down as a racial exclusion. The inclusion criteria for being able to join is usually basically stuff that Jews don't do.
Once again, I see Freemasonry as a distinct phenomenon from Judaism and is essentially a Gentile peasant merchant phenomenon. So I see them as two separate entities working together. They're not merged together. Even like with B'nai B'rith, the Jews have created their own sort of quasi-Masonic lodges of their own. There's definitely not a perfect alignment. There's not an eclipse of interest between the two. There are definitely crescents of differing goals. I would say that in the modern world, the organized Jewish tail certainly wags the Masonic dog. But to just sort of, I don't know what you're getting at here, other than perhaps a general defense of the Masonic tradition. Which,
that's precisely what I'm doing, yes.
Okay, well, I strongly disagree with you there, though I hope you'll agree with me that Freemasonry is utterly antithetical to authentic traditional Christianity.
That much I'll agree on. That's why I've asked the question.
Yeah.
Okay, my next question then. What do you think about the issue of the Tower of Babel and the legend of the creation of multiple ethnic groups, which this story refers to?
I see it as a largely allegorical rather than necessarily a literal. As I understand it, and I want to put a big asterisk in front of the Antifa listening to this, that I am not in any way qualified to state what Orthodox theology is, but as I understand it, the story of the Tower of Babel kind of explains and confirms the diversity, the linguistic and ethnic diversity of the world, and serves as a warning against those who would try to bring heaven down to earth, try to create a utopian civilization, try to actually defy God's plan, which is of a world, which is a patchwork of the distinct tribes and traditions he created. That's how I understand it.
Okay. That's quite different from what I was expecting. So that's fine. Would you be comfortable on commenting on what you think of Andrew Anglin and the Storm people in general?
I really like what Andrew Anglin is doing in many ways. It's not exactly our message. If it were our message, we would stop sharing our message, of course. But I think he's sort of tapping into the humor and the refusal to be beholden to all these taboos that our enemies put against us, like the sort of bizarro Nazism and the making jokes about lampshades and stuff. And you see that with like the Right Stuff's Daily Shoah, where these very intelligent and Anglin's very intelligent people are actually sort of lampooning all of these ridiculous and constricting taboos of the modern world, because people are just so burned out on it. It's like you can't say anything pro-white without them throwing the Holocaust in your face. And traditionally, the white nationalist movement has been torn between this sort of a stilted, well, we must disprove the Holocaust with history and stuff, or on the alternative, well, we must just accept the Holocaust and apologize for it and then move on. And, you know, what the modern generation is, they're just stepping over it. And to people who keep trying to draw it back to that, they're just making fun of them. And that's, I think, the best way to handle that. Rather than getting bogged down hugging the tar baby of the Holocaust war propaganda, just, you know, and the enemy doesn't really have a response to that. In a lot of ways, they're sort of the new church ladies, as far as like having no sense of humor, having no plasticity, you know, taking everything too seriously. And I don't know. I think Daily Stormer does a great job of keeping up with the latest events. There's a lot of facts there, more than the mainstream. I don't necessarily endorse everything he says or does, obviously.
Yeah.
But generally favorable.
Okay. Well, regarding this thing that you just mentioned about the Holocaust, actually, you mentioned just now that he's making jokes about lampshades and so on and so forth. To what extent, I mean, to me, from what I've seen overall of his site, while he does make these jokes about lampshades and this, that, and the other, he also then turns around and refers to it as the hollow hoax, showing that he doesn't believe that it occurred either.
Yeah.
For instance, on one of his latest articles, he refers to it as the hollow hoax and then says that something along the lines of it is good that Hitler did nothing wrong. The implication from this would have been is that he's implying that if it did happen, and it did, that it would be a wrong thing if he were to do that. So why it's almost as though he has in fact argued that the Holocaust is wrong by proxy, because he's saying that if it had in fact occurred, he would think it were wrong.
Okay, well. Part of the problem here is Anglin comes from like the 4chan internet troll community, where you can't just simply take everything he says at face value. He's trolling, you know, calling it the Hollow Hoax. It isn't necessarily saying I don't believe any Jews were persecuted or killed in World War II. It's a refusal and rejection of the implications of the Holocaust. So, I don't know whether in his heart of hearts he thinks the Germans went too far. He doesn't care. He's mocking it and moving past it as this limiting phenomenon for white interests.
That's why I've always liked Jonathan Bowden's approach to it more, because I remember Jonathan Bowden referring to it as I step over it. Over it. That was what he used to say. I always thought that was a wonderful thing for him to have said then. So, I mean, if people were to say that, I would have no particular problem. Stepping over it is precisely what I would like to see occur. It's just that when he uses this kind of rhetoric, it doesn't sound like that's what they're doing.
It's like with if you've listened to The Daily Show, it's like, oh, this guy, you know, stick him in the oven. That's, in my opinion, stepping over it. It's still there. You just don't let it... You don't let it get to you. You don't take it seriously. That's stepping over it. I spoke with Jonathan Bowden kind of briefly about this stuff. I met him. I was one of the last people. I saw him off to the airport. I was perhaps one of the last nationalists to actually see him before he passed away untimely. He's truly an amazing force in person. I don't know if you ever had a chance to meet him, but a true inspiration.
Yeah, he was an incredible person, definitely, for sure. I would not disagree with you on that. Which leads me to the next question, in fact. Matthew Heinbach, again, I know, I'm sorry. He has an image of himself on Twitter recently where he's standing in front of what looks like some kind of Holocaust memorial thing, or at least, I don't know, some kind of like Holocaust museum, I don't know. And behind him is like all of these pictures of these people giving the open palm salute to Adolf Hitler, of course. And
right.
he's holding a notice in front of it saying something about we're coming back or something like that. Yeah. Are you familiar with this photograph?
He trolled the Holocaust Museum.
Except he's wearing a T-shirt, which then of course has Russian or some kind of Russian Orthodox design on it with some text, which I couldn't read, unfortunately. How does he navigate, or how do you, all of you, including I suppose if you've had some conversations with Andrew Anglin, it'd be nice for you to also include him on this as well. How do you all navigate this contradiction between simultaneously venerating Axis, which I am not against the veneration of Axis, I'd like that to be clear for our audience. I am not against the veneration of Axis if you'd like to venerate Axis in some respects. But how do you reconcile this with veneration of Russia? Aren't these things intrinsically and almost irreconcilably against each other?
Yes. I mean, the basic final lodestar for us is that we're advocates for our faith, family, and folk. And our folk here in America are sort of the white American people, implicitly Christian. But looking at all these historical events, there's tremendous amount of complexity, and we don't necessarily pick sides on every single historical dispute. Obviously, I see the German National Socialists as having been identitarians, and I'm very much a National Socialist in that sense. I believe Kadrianu's model was far closer to my heart, but just as Kadrianu was sort of loosely allied with the Germans and with the Italians, we sort of have a broad general historical affinity with them against the Jewish powers. And I mean, as far as Russia, Russia's trying to work through.
It's quite a tangle that you end up in, because obviously the Germans were simultaneously allied with people like the Crimean Tatars, for example, who are definitely against Orthodox Christianity. And also, obviously, Germany's biggest partner in that war, Japan, was definitely against Orthodox Christianity and was, for all intents and purposes, against Russia holding any part of Siberia. The final plan that was supposed to have taken place, had in the event that Axis had won, would have been that Hideki Tojo would have met Adolf Hitler in Moscow, and together they were planning to undo the dams to actually flood Moscow to make it into an artificial lake. That was their intention, and that basically all the churches would be underground, essentially because of the fact that the water would be on top of everything. That was actually Hideki Tojo's plan.
As far as for myself, I see no obligation to be perfectly consistent about these things. All the people involved are dead and long since dead. I have these broad radical traditionalist principles, and some are more aligned than others. And you see this problem like with the contemporary Russians, with like National Bolshevism, and with like they're sort of turning from communism in a sense, but they're also like, there's sort of a romanticization of a lot of the Bolshevik era too, and of the USSR.
Exactly. To what extent does it make cooperation with them in the now extremely difficult because of the fact that they're venerating a moment in history at which they were placed in an existential crisis, and they managed to escape from that existential crisis much through the chagrin of many of the people who support Axis, for example.
I mean, to some extent, what we're shooting for is a global alliance of those with identitarian and traditionalist principles, like you see with the Russians and Syrians right now. I'd like to see that expanded somewhat, and I see Russia as a central force in that, not necessarily the only force. And you have to understand, I'm loyal to the radical traditionalist principles and to the Orthodox faith, not to Russia. to the extent that Russia has, in the past few decades, come to be sort of an island of hope in many ways in defense of identity and tradition the world over. We're very hopeful about that. And the way that Russia sort of re-embraced the Orthodox Christian faith is very inspiring for us. And yeah, I see if current trends manifest, I see Russia as playing a very important role in the future and could be the decisive factor in saving my tribe, which is the tribe I'm accountable for, from oblivion.
Okay, so what extent is that a tactic on their part for energy interests, though? For example, they're embracing of these things in the absence of communism, and then they're turning around and trying to lobby nationalist groups in the European Union. This is all about their energy interests, isn't it? Because obviously Gazprom and Gazprom Bank would like to have complete control over the, or to the extent that it is possible, to have as maximum amount of control they can possibly attain over energy sources running into Europe. And so if they can disrupt the European Parliament by essentially pretending to be on your side, why wouldn't they do that? Isn't there something suspicious about all this? Isn't it part of their information war?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's not a mistake that realpolitik is a loan word from the Russian language. And this is a very... geopolitics is a complicated, sticky thing where you have discrete national interests and the ideologies are often merely stalking horses for pragmatic, you know, where in Syria do their identitarian and traditionalist defense of Assad's third positionist regime end, and where does their defense of their warm water seaport begin? And you know, I'm idealist, but I also understand the world as it is, and I understand that our interests aren't perfectly aligned with the Russians or with anybody else but ourselves, and that's just human, you know, human nature. But what you can hope for is to try to come to an understanding, try to build an alliance, just like with the Cold War, of loosely affiliated, you know, powers that have a vague common interest. And you know, going back to Vietnam, you know, what was communism in the Vietnam War? It was largely an avatar of nationalism.
In that particular case, it was a proxy for actual nationalist interest, because the enemy's people wanted to unite Indochina under their hegemony, and so the whole socialist thing became a proxy for that. In their case, in fact, it was even said that the Russians themselves had realized this, and that was why privately they were treating them in such a kind of strangely contemptuous way, even though they were helping them. It was because of the fact that they realized that the Vietnamese weren't necessarily on the same train that they were on.
Right, and that's what you get with that. I just don't. If you're trying to imply that the road ahead for us is going to be perilous, complicated, and unclear, with a lot of challenges and contradictions and historical obstacles to overcome, I wholeheartedly agree with you. This is certainly, we've got our work cut out for us, as I do believe everyone else following a different identitarian strategy has as well. I think we're just more honest about about it. Let me ask a couple questions. Do you think it's possible or even necessary for Europe to have a truly parochial religious tradition, which does not in any way interface with or adapt from the rest of the world?
Yes, I think it is possible to some extent, because obviously when you're in the world interacting with everyone else, you can't come up with something that's completely original. And the goal should not be originality really anyway, because if your goal is to simply be original, then you might as well give up from the start, because it's not a real belief at that point. You're just trying to be edgy. And so, no, I don't think there should be a parochial...
Well, original to Europe.
Original to Europe. By original to Europe, of course, that means a slightly different thing, which is, you know, that European minds would have come up with it. To that extent, I think it's a good idea to try to create something like that. And by create, I don't mean just making it up whole cloth, but I mean obviously going back to the past, back to the pre-Christian era, and trying to find what used to really be part of the European mind and kind of bringing that to the fore. And that's what I think a lot of these things which have like neo-dash something or the other in front of them are really trying to do. Even though it sounds like it's new, it's kind of like new from the past because they're having to reinvent things which were purged before by the incidents of Christianity. And so for instance, when you talk about neo-paganism, for example, neo-paganism would essentially be an attempt to revive paganism and bring it back to the fore. Can I hear GW asking to break in.
And, yes, and just you can if you make a small contribution at this point, because it's something which I think is quite important to understand. The European mind is a reasonably ancient artifact, and over the greater course of the European life, we did not follow a fundamentally Judaic prescription. We had an immense attachment to place. That attachment was to the earth and the land which we shaped, and to the heavens. And as much as it did that, it caught us as creatures of eternity and creatures of time. And I think that the idea that there isn't great profundity in what could be emergent from us, this word emergent is very, very important. It can't be forced. You cannot invent this sort of thing. You cannot rediscover it as some kind of archaeology exercise. The only thing that you can truly do is to turn to one's own truth and to be still and to await the expression of it through oneself, just the formative capacity of the mind to make the world. And that is the way that something like I wouldn't say a new religion per se in terms of a structured entity, but anyway, a new application for faith, which I see as being a genetic capacity of the emotional center of the brain, can come into being. So, you know, I think it is possible. I think it is immensely difficult. I think that Christianity forms a very, very serious and non-productive obstruction. I think that the wonderful beauty of and creativity of our kind can be expressed. It has been expressed in different ways and that have not been related to our faith capacity down the last 200 years, for sure. I mean, we have the most incredible aesthetic, scientific life that we've given to the world. But I think that the most important thing is something that comes from a much more still place than that, and is about life and about evolution even. These things are not actually, you know, faith and evolution are not in fact in conflict with one another. It's all life. And we can make a space within ourselves for this to gradually emerge and for everything to be synthesized. It would take a great deal more than just an act of ethnic stillness, of turning within to do that, however that might actually be achieved in itself. It would take a reconnection with a certain quality of knowledge, and it would take persons of great intelligence and charismatic power to champion that, because that is the way that these things happen. That is where the heat is created to make them, you know, a furnace of belief and attachment and devotion. So, you know, all of this is possible. We're not Christians in eternity. We've got this damn thing around our necks now, from my point of view. And I regard those who are attached to it as being highly honourable people, but flies attached to flypaper. And we can only deal with that by producing out of ourselves, over time, something much more powerful and much, much more meaningful. So, you know, I'm an optimist on that score. I wouldn't like to say that it's going to happen anytime soon. I'll shut up again now.
No, it's no problem. I think you've answered it. I think you've given an explanation better than the one that I could have given, which is very good, I think. Well, I'll give Matt the opportunity to respond.
Respond to that if you want.
Yes, definitely. Go on.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm definitely the intelligent and charismatic person to lead the white race forward.
Obviously,
definitely. It's second only, perhaps, to Donald Trump himself.
Donald,
the true second race. As far as it's funny you call Christianity damnable, being that the word damnable is itself a Christian.
I
think that. Yes, you did.
I'll have to check.
Well, I'm not objecting to your insulting. I'm saying that we're damned, that you yourself have been imbued with that much Christian habit of thinking. That even when you attempt to curse Christian, you do so in an implicitly Christian way. Yeah. So, I think something I've seen in a lot of neo-pagan things. A lot of ways they end up with the same sort of monotheistic. Levantine framework for thinking, even when they think they're rebelling against Christianity.
It's something that people have to be on guard against, of course.
I don't know if they can completely guard themselves against this. It's too ingrained at this point,
it's
in my opinion.
Habit. It has no meaning in itself.
Well, that's...
One of the essentials of understanding anything about this is that you begin from the precept that we're creatures of time and place, and in that much we're unconscious, we're mechanistic in a large degree, and we're given to human absence, and that we do not have the capacity to steer ourselves in any truly conscious way, either individually or collectively. And that's the fundamental beginning. You know, we've been formed. If you want to turn away from that, then you have to go on some kind of journey towards consciousness, towards light. This is a fact, and you have to accept that that takes you out, lifts you out. In Heideggerian terms, there is an unconcealing and an event of appropriation, and this language that they apply to this journey, at which point something authentic asserts itself, and other possibilities which did not exist before arise. So, you know, this is really what I'm trying to talk about in a very highfalutin and vague way. So if I use language from time and place, by all means, you can comment on the fact. But that language does not belong to the journey. That language belongs to that part of us from which we have to detach, from that which we have acquired, which is not us. It's simply behavioral habit.
Okay. Well, I didn't mean to... imply that you would utterly invalidate yourself. I just found that an amusing side note on the challenge of how.
Well,
you know,
unfortunately, I have no sense of humor at all, as the whole world knows. So, Matt, you know, you're on a loser. Every time you make a small quip at my expense, I will always return with some dreadful and earnest and incredibly sleep-inducing reiteration of where I was about 30 minutes ago in my exegesis. And my apologies for that tendency.
No.